This is the story of a man who lived life on the inside. The inside of the earth, that is. No, he wasn't one of those mole people I talked about way early on in this channel. He believed that the rest of us were right here on the inside with him. Cyrus Teed was a Union veteran of the American Civil War who saw a vision that led him to pursue alchemy and told him that he was the final messiah. But in addition to the magical, religious aspects of his belief system, Teed also belonged to the political subvariant of cult leaders. Teed would certainly consider himself a leftist in his time. His three main issues were that he hated capitalism, hated patriarchy, and hated sexual intercourse. So he was like a proto-Gen Z leftist then. Oh, and there was the whole Hollow Earth thing. Teed garnered a small following of primarily women. As they wandered across the United States, they found a final home in, I'm going to give you three guesses, Florida. Let's take a walk into the world of Hollow Earth, 19th century voluntary celibacy, and early sci-fi dystopian literature. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian and Thimble the Doll, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosity. Cyrus R. Teed was born in 1839 in upstate New York. The area he was from during the time he grew up there was known as the Burned Over District. What this part of the Northeast was burning with was religious fervor. For the whole first half of the 19th century, a movement known as the Second Great Awakening swept America, and the alarm clock that triggered the awakening was the Burned Over District. Christian revivalist movements were popping up all over that area. So were left-wing utopian movements, and it was typically hard to tell where religion ended and activism began. Ideas like vegetarianism, proto-socialism, free love, and women's rights became popular, but almost all of these were motivated by Christian fundamentalism. Communes sprung up based around each of these movements, and more. Not every strange new idea to sweep the Burned Over District was rooted in Christianity either. The first wave of interest in spiritualism, with the first seances as they're known today, came from three sisters in the Burned Over District too. Folk magic, divining, psychics, even a revival of medieval alchemy, all of those came into their modern forms during the Second Great Awakening in the Burned Over District. Many spiritual leaders from these movements were among the strongest crusaders for the abolition of slavery too. Surviving religious sects that originated in that maelstrom of spirituality include Seventh-day Adventism, arguably Jehovah's Witnesses, although they were founded after the Civil War, and the Burned Over District's biggest hit, Mormonism. Teed himself was a distant relative of Joseph Smith. It was a strange time and place in which to grow up. One where declaring yourself to be the Messiah and creating your own bizarre beliefs about the shape of the universe was still weird, but probably less weird than in any other time and place, except California in the 60s. During Teed's life, he was an avid reader of medicine, science, history, alchemy, and religion. He regularly moved in the alternative circles of the Shakers and read the writings of Emanuel Swedenborg. The Shakers were a Christian religious movement that was against sex and who regularly got confused for the pacifist Christian movement, the Quakers. Both Quakers and Shakers, like many sects, originally didn't call themselves that. Quakers were nicknamed that because their founder told followers to tremble at the word of the Lord, but Shakers literally did, with their chaotic, ecstatic dancing at their church services. Today, there are two members of the Shaker sect left. Two. Swedenborg, meanwhile, was a Renaissance-era scientist from Sweden. I love it when people's nationality is part of their name. And while his wide-ranging inventions and discoveries basically made him the Scandinavian Isaac Newton, he was also something of the Scandinavian Joseph Smith, announcing a divine revelation at age 53 and devoting the rest of his life to his strange pseudo-Christian spiritual beliefs. Newton had strange pseudo-Christian spiritual beliefs too, come to think of it, but he didn't try to start his own sect out of it. Swedenborg did. Possibly his most unusual and distinctive belief was that the second coming of Jesus had already happened and we just didn't notice. An idea that some Second Great Awakening cults slash revival movements borrowed, although what people thought the implications of saying this were varied. The Quakers, the Shakers, and the Swedenborgians all predated the Second Great Awakening and didn't originally come from the burned over district, but their ideas were hugely influential on almost everything that came out of there. Cyrus Teed, knowledgeable about all these beliefs, was drafted into the Civil War, where he served as an army doctor, until he was discharged from the Union Army for a presumed medical disability in 1863. Not clear what that was. He then went to Eclectic Medical College of the City of New York, my second episode subject who is a graduate of an Eclectic Medical College, and after graduating, returned to his hometown of Utica to practice medicine. Electricity was new in those days, and like many new technologies, quacks began claiming it could cure diseases. Teed was very interested in the medical use of electricity and did dangerous high-voltage experiments in his house. During the winter of 1869-1870, Teed claimed to have a mystical vision, which he called an illumination. He wrote about it 20 years later, stating that it occurred in his electroalchemical library, which, I mean, I'll be honest, when you've got an electroalchemical library, where else would you expect to get a mystical vision? A beautiful goddess appeared to him and said,
I have brought thee to this earth to sacrifice thee upon the altar of all human hope, that through thy quickening of me, thy mother and bride, the sons of God shall spring into visible creation.
Look there, my signs, in that surging mass of human woe thou seest one into whom I shall in time descend in my sensory ultimate, and for a time in the future, and not now, shall walk with thee. In this thy going, the divine hand shall lead thee, lest thy feet stumble. This vision began the core justification for Teed's creation of his cult and his views on life. He then interpreted this new mission from Old Testament passages in the book of Isaiah. 11:10, "In that day the root of Jesse shall stand as an ensign to the people. Him shall the nation seek, and his dwelling shall be glorious." What's the root of Jesse? Well, literally it means a descendant of King David. Christians these days mostly interpret that line to mean Jesus was a descendant of King David. Teed thought it meant him. Teed changed his name from Cyrus to Koresh, because it was the Persian translation of Cyrus mentioned in the book of Isaiah. Teed viewed God as feminine and insisted that total abstinence from sex would, quote, increase the transforming power of the spirit and provide immortality. All right, I'm glad he included the immortality part, that take care of the how are we supposed to make babies then question. He also saw himself as the seventh and final Messiah, believing he was a reincarnation of Jesus, but that there had also been six previous reincarnations of Jesus since Jesus himself, and these were the seven seals, the signal of the apocalypse in the book of Revelation, the last book of the canonical Bible. Clearly, this takes inspiration from Swedenborg's belief that the second coming had already happened. A forerunner of the use of the name Cyrus for an end times messianic figure appears in the 1699 book 60 Propositions by English mystic Jane Ledd, who prophesied the coming of a David, a Cyrus, and a Christ in the flesh who would restore total and full redemption after the seven seals are opened. Another religious leader who identified with figures in the book of Revelation and sought to open the seven seals was Hong Xiuquan, who had a remarkably similar divine vision in 1837, all the way over in China, and began calling himself the younger brother of Jesus Christ, leading the bloody Taiping Rebellion. In the magazine he later published for his followers, The Flaming Sword, Teed wrote that past messiahs were, quote, present in him, and he was the cumulative expression of them all. In Teed's proofs that he was the final messiah, he cited 2 Thessalonians 2:3, in which the Apostle Paul writes that in the last days, a man will arise claiming that he's divine, but this figure will be a, quote, man of sin. Teed claimed that he, Cyrus Teed, was this man of sin. In other words, he was basically proclaiming himself to be the Antichrist. That's new. But Teed thought that wasn't quite what Paul meant when he wrote about a man of sin. Teed said that even though he was the seventh messiah, who is a deity, he was born a man, and thus was also the man of sin predicted to come in the end times, i.e. divine but also human, therefore sinful, Popedes Nerfect. For Teed, the final Christ was a, quote, conjunction of the divine and sinful human. This is an unheard of claim in Christian history from someone claiming to be a messiah. T Teed also saw himself as the Lion of the Tribe of Judah and the Lamb of Revelation 5:9, who was able to open the seven seals and interpret them. Teed also challenged anyone in the world to try and read the seven seals. Since it's genuinely not clear what the seven seals alluded to in the Book of Revelation even are, nobody took Teed up on his challenge, but his interpretation that the seven seals constitute second through eighth comings of Christ was pretty unique. Koreshian beliefs were focused on the end of the world, celibacy, and creating a communal lifestyle. He eschewed private property and capitalistic exchange. The goal of spiritual improvement was to reach involution, which he saw as a state of perfection and harmony with the cosmos. Enlightenment, basically. What people most remember today about Koresh's beliefs was his loopy cosmology. He was a hollow earther, and not the only one. Hollow earth theories are like the acid-tripping little brother of flat earth theories. Hollow earthers, for a while, weren't quite as crazy as flat earthers. Even the ancient Egyptians knew the world was round. The myth that the true shape of the world wasn't discovered until the Age of Discovery is just that. But what's inside the earth? Renaissance-era astronomers, including Edmund Halley of Comet fame, speculated that it could be hollow. And if it is, who knows, maybe there's another whole civilization inside there. It wasn't officially disproven until the 18th century, and remained popular in pop culture for a century afterward. These days, hollow earthers are still around, and they're very similar to flat earthers. Some of them believe UFOs originate from an alien civilization inside Earth and emerge through holes at the North and South Poles, which, of course, the powers that be are keeping you from knowing about. I'd love to see a formal debate between a flat earther and a hollow earther. During World War II, some high-ranking Nazis were allegedly interested in the idea that the German master race was descended from Hyperboreans, a mythical race of people who supposedly once lived in the far north. Hyperborea, far north, get it? But some Nazi mystics believed that the Hyperboreans didn't originally live in the far north, that was just where they came out of the pole hole from their real home on another planet nested inside the Earth. But Teed's conception of a hollow Earth was, once again, unique. He too thought that people lived on the inside of a hollow Earth, but that those people were us. He thought that what we think of as Earth was the concave inner surface of an egg-like structure. In the center was the sun, surrounded by the stars, which aren't physical objects, they're an optical illusion created by the scattering of sunlight. If you shot a rocket far up enough into the air from the US, in Teed's cosmology, you'd eventually zip past the sun and then splash straight down into the Indian Ocean on the opposite side of the Earth from America. Teed's idea of the sun was like the rotating beam of a lighthouse, only giving out light from one side, which is why it's night on one side of the Earth when it's day on the other side. I'm not sure he was able to explain why sunrises and sunsets look like they do. You kinda need to be on a convex surface for that to work. If I were creating a fantasy world that worked like this, I'd add one more fun detail. I'd say, no, the sun just turns itself off at night. It's either night everywhere or day everywhere, so that when you look up at night and see the stars, what you're actually seeing are the lights of cities on the other side of the Earth. I just think that's a cool idea. But that's my invention, not Teed's, since his theory predates the widespread adoption of electric lights. In his time, you probably couldn't see city lights at night from space. In 1880, Teed established his first commune in Moravia, New York, but he and his followers, quote, alienated the residents, which caused him to move to nearby Syracuse. Sources do not say what he did to ostracize himself from the community. While in Syracuse, Cyrus established the Syracuse Institute of Progressive Medicine. However, his organization was not welcome and later caused him to move to New York City in the mid-1880s and again to Chicago in 1886. While in Chicago, Teed and his followers attended the Convention of Mental Scientists, where at the convention he lectured about how there was a scientific possibility of eliminating death and creating a new force generated from the brain. What did he mean by that? Yeah. His core group of followers tended always to be women. While in Chicago, he set up his publishing house, Guiding Star Publishing, and its monthly periodical, The Guiding Star, which was subtitled A Magazine Devoted to the Science of Being, or Spiritual Healing, an Essential Department. While in Chicago, he did use the terms Koreshian theology and Koreshian school, but he did not yet refer to himself in print as Koresh. That didn't start until 1891. And since I'm sure some of you were already thinking, wait, a pseudo-Christian cult leader named Koresh. Where have I heard that one before? Yes, I'll address it now because it doesn't really fit anywhere else in the script. David Koresh, the leader of the much more recent Branch Davidian cult, who made national news for their violent standoff with the FBI in Waco, Texas in 1993, he also changed his name to Koresh. During the siege of the Davidians' compound, FBI agents asked David Koresh if he knew about the previous cult leader who used that name. He claimed to have never heard of Cyrus Teed. Some biographers are sure he had to have gotten the name from Teed, but either way, their belief systems weren't remotely similar. Back to Teed. Within his community, membership had three ascending levels: investigative, meritable, and celibate communal. The first level was seen as the most secular, and it was for those who had some cooperative economic relation with the Koreshian community. Second level was for husbands and wives who believed that marriage was for procreation only. Third level was for those who were church leaders and where most members of the community belonged. They weren't allowed to marry or have sex at all. In 1890, Teed traveled the U.S. preaching his message, where he noted in San Francisco that ladies represented the bulk of his hearers, and that he was the reincarnated Messiah, in which he was promised to come for the final redemption of the race. Meaning the human race, I think. He did try to establish a community in the Bay Area, of course. If anything is the new burned-over district, it's the Bay Area, but it was short-lived. Around the same time, the labor movement and early socialism were growing, especially in industrial cities like Chicago. 19th century progressive activism in America was heavily tied up in fundamentalist Christianity. Some of the most forceful anti-slavery and women's rights campaigners were fire and brimstone Christians. Even the early Mormons were strongly against slavery, and they only adopted their famous long-standing ban on black clergy members once they were well established in Utah, in a bid to seem more normal to the rest of America, in hope it would get Utah statehood. In the years after the Civil War, by the time Marxism became popular and the fight for an 8-hour workday and the establishment of a minimum wage were the main goals that stirred up massive protests, Christianity was becoming less and less central to the American left, but it was still certainly more prominent than it is today, as were other beliefs that we would think of today as socially conservative and not leftist at all. Teed's belief in the evils of sex and marriage was not unique to him, nor was combining that with socialism. Many suffragettes and proto-feminists of the time saw sex inherently as a tool of male oppression, which I think says more about them than it does about patriarchy. Prohibition of alcohol, another thing Teed made central to his cult, was also seen as a progressive cause, opposed by the deep pockets of the beverage lobby and big city boss politicians. If you want to know what leftist infighting was like in the 1880s, read about the schisms in the Prohibition Party over whether they should adopt pro-women suffrage and workers' rights planks, or if they should just be about banning alcohol. The omni-cause discourse is older than you think. Feminism, socialism, prohibitionism, all those things belonged within Koreshianity's shell earth. Teed had his own neologism for business and capitalism, referring to the economic conditions he wanted to stamp out as competeism. The 1890s saw extensive legal issues for Cyrus Teed. On May 14, 1892, Sidney C. Miller, president of the National Publishing Company, a Chicago firm, filed suit against Teed for, quote, alienation of affection, i.e., stealing his wife. Miller accused Teed of, quote, poisoning Mrs. Miller's mind and alienating her affection. He also fraudulently represented himself as Elijah the Prophet, claiming he had miraculous powers, which included power to give and take life and eventually to destroy the world. Miller also claimed Teed told Mrs. Miller she would be made into the goddess Minerva, that marriage, sex, and sexual love should be abandoned, and that she should leave her husband and join the Koreshian community. She was also asked that she turn over to Teed all her earthly possessions, which was valued at $5,000. That would be $176,000 today. Miller asked for damages in the sum of $100,000, which is $3.5 million in 2025. The case ended up being dismissed by the judge. It also appears Miller's publishing company was a rival of Teed, and he was harassing Teed because of his women's liberation stances. After Miller's legal actions ended, another Chicago husband, Thomas Cole, initiated similar lawsuits against Teed. Cole attained the same attorney that Miller hired, William H. Hill, to sue Teed. This time, Cole charged Teed with the crime of adultery and again asked for $100,000 in damages. Teed was represented by the same lawyer, Charles W. Greenfield, who later became a follower of Teed. The case was dismissed and reinstated and dismissed multiple times. I'm sure by that point, all the repetitive lawsuits were getting tedious. After several other lawsuits alleging the same issues and ongoing rumors that Teed was going to be lynched, in 1894, Teed bought land from William T. Dodd in Lee County, Florida, near Estero. 16 miles southwest of Fort Myers. However, there's another account that says Teed convinced a German immigrant named Tom Koller to become a Koreshan and give his 320 acres at Estero to the Koreshans for the site of what they called their New Jerusalem. Either way, it was time for Teed to become the original Florida man. Teed's plans for creating New Jerusalem were noted in the Chicago Herald. Two members told reporters, "When we opened our work in Chicago 9 years ago, the press of Chicago opened a warfare of slander which it has pursued almost uninterrupted till the present time. We do not object to being called cranks, visionaries, impracticable, etc., but it has been difficult for us to stem the tide of lying slanders of a vituperous and monopolistic press like the great dailies of Chicago. Despite the efforts of the press of Chicago and the country, abetted by the Orthodox clergy, we have made some progress. We have held our community together in the great Babylon of modern church and court." Before the move to Florida, it was estimated that there were 160 Koreshans in Illinois, 15 in California, 15 in Massachusetts, and 15 here in Oregon. Why am I not surprised? Once they had all resettled in Florida, his followers numbered around 200. Teed started a paper, The American Eagle, and his own political party, the Progressive Liberty Party, to control civil affairs within his community. He also opened a printing plant, created his own university, Koreshan University, and incorporated his land into the town. Teed's plan was to build a community that created a, quote, metropolis of millions of whites and blacks, following the principles of Koreshanity. Outside of the Hollow Earth beliefs, Teed wanted people of all races to live in harmony and equality. He also regularly criticized the mainstream Christian churches because of their oppression of women. Followers of Teed also did not partake in alcohol, tobacco, did not curse, and, except for a small number of families, abstained from sex. Koreshans also regularly put on concerts, plays, and operas for themselves. Those who lived within New Jerusalem did not own personal property. The members helped in construction of the settlement, maintaining the gardens, food growing and prep, laundry and schooling. They ran their own store to cater to travelers along the Tamiami Trail, which is now Highway 41. New Jerusalem survived long enough to coexist with the age of the automobile, so for a while they had a gas station too. They also sold their own surplus produce and their own garden ornaments. Once they moved to Florida, Teed worked on projects to create his new order and prove that the world was a hollow sphere. Teed wanted to create a series of experiments, and one of his followers, Ulysses Morrow, invented a device called the rectilineator, which he claimed would prove the hollow Earth. It was an optical surveying device that was able to measure the curve of the Earth. Supposedly, sure enough, it proved that the Earth was concave. Teed also dipped his hand into city planning, working on creating his New Jerusalem, which was to follow a star-shaped city layout of broad streets and parks. It was supposed to have underground tunnels to supply his city with electricity, clean water, and sewage. No further information regarding his experiments to prove the Hollow Earth came out, and the Koreshans didn't have enough of a workforce to build a whole city, although they did have the land. Around the dawn of the 20th century, New Jerusalem was the fifth largest incorporated city by area in the whole United States, since farmland in Florida was cheap and Teed incorporated all of his land as the future site of his city. The local government and neighbors were not bothered by their new residents with their unconventional beliefs. As long as the community remained small and Teed restrained from involvement in local politics, they were treated as charming eccentrics. This ended in 1904, when Teed sought to further incorporate his followers into Lee County society. He ran several of his followers in Democratic primaries for county-level positions, insulting the incumbent officials and declaring the impending triumph of Koreshanity. Of course, they didn't have nearly enough voters to defeat the existing politicians. This led to the Democratic political establishment disincorporating the city of New Jerusalem. Tensions rose between the locals and the cultists. In 1906, Koreshans and Floridians came to blows, literally. A group of Teed's followers, including Teed himself, were waiting at the Fort Myers train station for the arrival of a new member when they were accosted by a, quote, disgruntled hotelier named Mr. Sellers, who believed that his wife had been insulted by a Koreshan over the telephone. The argument turned into a brawl. Soon, several Koreshans were fighting several Fort Myers residents in the street. Teed, a week shy of his 67th birthday, pushed his way into the melee, attempting to break up the fight. It was a bad choice. Police were called, but they just beat up the Koreshans even worse. The street brawl in Fort Myers left Teed in severe nerve pain that lasted for the remaining 2 years of his life. Teed milked the attack for all it was worth, saying that it was due to Teed's political enemies, and further fit his narrative that, like Jesus, he was a persecuted messiah. The attack left Teed to deputize his follower Victoria Gracia as Empress of the Koreshan Unity, to oversee relations between the cult and outsiders. While he retreated to recover, he wrote a futuristic war novel titled The Great Red Demon, or The Flaming Devil of the Orient, which he wrote under the pen name Lord Chester. It was published by the Koreshans' Guiding Star Publishing House, but not until 1909, after Teede had died. The title is a reference to the dragon who appeared in the 12th chapter of the Book of Revelation, in which a woman clothed with the sun is flung by the monster's tail from heaven to earth, and her son is prophesied to battle the forces of Satan, represented by a seven-headed, ten-horned dragon. Teede saw the woman in this vision as representations of the goddess that allowed him to figure out how to transform base metals into gold. Yeah, he claimed his whole life that he could do that, while he lived back in upstate New York. The novel opens with a cabal of businessmen from six of the greatest commercial enterprises in the world, plotting to unite the governments of the industrialized Christian West against their common threats, domestic labor, and aggressive Chinese competition, which I guess you could take as weirdly prophetic, especially since China certainly wasn't a major world power in 1909. It takes place in 1988 and is set in New York, where powerful monopolies create huge concentrations of wealth inequality between the classes. Great so-called rings of monopolistic trust determine, quote, all aspects of economic life in this utilitarian land, leaving the country with high mortality rates, government-assisted suicides, and accelerated devolution that left people, quote, undersized, hungry-looking, and hopeless subhumans. The story follows the International Brotherhood of Destruction, which is a fun name for a supervillain team, but they're actually the good guys. What they plan to destroy is the oligarchy and the Chinese. The novel's title was evocative of the American nativist sentiment towards Chinese immigrants around then. The Chinese Exclusion Act was 20 years old, and America was still consumed with the Yellow Peril panic, an unfounded and frankly bizarre belief that Chinese immigrants would outbreed whites and take over the country. Teede may have been fine with black people, but he was still a man of his times. But when Teede wrote about his fears of China, what he really meant was a different Asian country, one that was rising then, not declining like China. For Teede, his fear of Asian power was rooted in the 1905 Russo-Japanese War, another intersection with a previous Tor's Cabinet episode topic. The Russian loss against the Japanese was seen as a major blow to European racial superiority. Racist as this book may have been, I'm fascinated at the strangely accurate choice of writing a book set in 1988 in which a major part of the plot is American businessmen's fear of Japanese economic dominance. Reminds me of one of the highest grossing movies from the actual year of 1988. Here's a photo of the Koreshans putting on a play version of this sci-fi novel. They put on these elaborate performances just for themselves. Teede succumbed to his injuries from the assault in 1908. His remaining followers stayed by his corpse for weeks, believing he would return to life, until the authorities forced a burial. The followers came from urban and middle-class backgrounds. Most lacked practical skills in agriculture and horticulture. They were largely from Chicago and not well-versed in Florida swamp life. However, they had, quote, good business sense, diverse economic activity, and worked with the land to enable a successful venture. They ended up building over 20 structures that are still standing today. In 1921, in a poetic ending, a hurricane swept Teed's tomb and coffin into the ocean. From then on, the community suffered from schisms, desertions, and changes. Teed's son, Douglas, who he had before his religious awakening led him to swear off sex, left the cult and became an influential painter. Koreshanity lasted well into the 1960s, long after Teede died, when the land was finally given to the state of Florida to serve as a state park. His community still published his work and magazine, The Flaming Sword, until the last member died in 1982. With perhaps a bit more charisma and a little less sex negativity, Teede could have become like his distant relative, Joseph Smith. Koreshans could have become a fundamental part of the fabric of American cultural weirdness, just like Mormons. As it is, his beliefs went into the Florida swamplands and never came out, leaving us all to wonder, what in earth was Cyrus Teede thinking?
Man and Grey will get you now. You've got to hide or take the blame.